We've never done a recording of Friday afternoon. I don't think
we haven't. No, I mean Friday afternoon is normally reserved for doing absolutely nothing because I'm normally shattered. But I'm feeling it today.
Yeah. Well, how much of this is something though?
That's a very good point. That's a very good point.
But, I kind of feel like the conversations we have outside of the podcast were pretty much similar to mostly.
Yeah, it's all drivel, isn't it?
Yeah.
Our drivel on other people.
It's wrapped up to be meaningful, but I don't think it is.
No, it's like I tell you what this podcast is like. This podcast is like a pig in blanket at a Christmas dinner, except you bite into it, and all that wasn't a sausage; that was a cat turd.
Yeah, that's it. Yep. Yeah, I think you nailed
it. Roll the music.
Yeah, there we go.
Welcome to the Gaps in Knowledge podcast. I'm Will. I'm a historian who knows nothing about geography.
And I'm Reese, and I'm a geographer that knows nothing about history.
And this week, I'm enjoying a Roman dinner party. I'm playing ancient games in some rather questionable clothing. And maybe, just maybe, I'm going to get Reese to believe in magic through the wonderful world of chess.
Oh, dear Lord. Okay, well, for me this week, I'm going to get all atmospherically gassy, park my solar panel car at Walmart, and head off to Mecca to see how it is.
You can't promise the boys and girls you're going to get gassy. That's not audibly okay.
They need to listen and find out. That's what they need to do. Am I going first this time to Misconception Corner? I am more than happy to go into Misconception Corner. And my question to you is, what is the most abundant greenhouse gas?
Ooh. I mean, the most famous one's carbon dioxide. I feel like that's your Michael Jackson of greenhouse gases. Everyone knows it. Everyone doesn't particularly like it. But then methane, like cows do love a good fart, don't they?
Oh, they're very fond of that. It's more their burps actually that are the problem.
Is it?
Yeah.
Right.
But the other end does also play a part.
It's cow season at the moment here in Austria. They're bringing the cows down from the high meadows down to the valley for winter.
You do live in the Shire.
I do, absolutely. And the weird thing is, everyone gets dressed up in their dirndls and lederhosen because they do that at the drop of a hat. They'll do that just for the sake of it. But they get the cows dressed up too. They put big headdresses on the cows. It's brilliant.
Do the cows have any consent in this?
Absolutely not, because what I didn't realize until today, me living in my naive world of vegetarianism, I thought they brought the cows down just because they don't want them to be cold up in the mountains. Oh. But no, they're going to slaughter them.
They're leading them to the abattoir.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Yeah. To go back to your answer,
I'm going to say carbon dioxide.
Wrong and wrong.
Wrong and wrong. Oh, okay.
Actually, I mean, you could have another guess if you want, but I fear this answer is one of these ones where you've probably overlooked something very basic.
Uh-huh. Well, I feel like carbon dioxide is probably the misconception. So
yeah.
I'm sat very firmly in Misconception Corner having a lovely time.
You have.
But if you say it's very basic, I'm going to guess water.
Yep, you're pretty much there. So water vapor is the most abundant greenhouse gas. And it's a massive misconception. And but there needs to be a little bit of context of this before you can kind of go spouting off and say water vapor is the most abundant greenhouse gas. There's a bit of context that's needed. That's very, no pun intended, quite literally, because I didn't notice it.
Well, there you go. I'll count that down as 2-0 then.
Yeah, why not? So, I've got some values here to kind of put into it. So, carbon dioxide out of sort of the greenhouse gases, yes, there's a lot of it. It contributes 76% to the greenhouse effect. So, in that sense, it's the biggest player. And it is in our atmosphere by volume, there is 0.041%, which in other money is 410 parts per million.
Okay. So, right. Oh, that makes sense, because you always see about parts per million.
Yeah,
and that's shot up, hasn't it, from like... Have you got the figures there for them, how much it's increased?
No, I haven't got the figures, but yeah, but if you were to look at a graph of carbon dioxide that goes into the atmosphere, it rockets up since about 1900s. That's just industrial revolution. That's when we start to see huge amounts of carbon dioxide. And then the next one, you said you read it in order, then it is methane at 0.0018%, which is 1.8 parts per million. Mm-hmm. But what's really interesting about methane is, even though it contributes just to 16% of the greenhouse effect, it is is one of the worst greenhouse gases per particle. So it reflects more sunlight back to the earth compared to a carbon dioxide particle. So it's more powerful. It's like, imagine it being more dense, I suppose, and reflects more heat back in its real basic term. And then it's like, gone.
Carbon dioxide's like beer and methane's like whiskey.
Yes, that's a really good way. And then you've got, then even beyond that, you've got nitrous oxide, N2O, that's 0.33 parts per million, that's 6% contribution. And then you've got fluorinated gases, they're called carbon fluorocarbons, you get them in aerosols. And they're pretty, if you get those in the atmosphere, like refrigerators used to have them and emit them, and it used to even break the ozone layer as well. It used to be a real problem. But this is where water vapor comes in. So actually water vapor, and it's interesting, it varies across the earth. Sometimes there is 0% kind of in terms of like 0.001% in volume, but in some places it's up to 4% in terms of its atmospheric volume.
Oh wow.
So it's very dynamic across all of the planet, and is a huge sort of player in actually the greenhouse effect. Without water vapor, we have no real greenhouse gas at all. It's one of the most major players that keeps our earth insulated like a greenhouse, because people tend to forget you have the greenhouse effect, which is a natural phenomenon the earth experiences that keeps it habitable for everyone. And then you have the enhanced greenhouse effect, which is the one where you've got all of the carbon dioxide, methane, nitrous oxide, and fluoro gases up there. That's the stuff that is contributing to anthropogenic climate change.
It's a bit counterintuitive that water vapor is such a strong contributor, because of course, using your dumb brain, when it's cloudy, it's not as warm, but that's not the point, is it?
No.
It's the overall density of everything that's in the atmosphere, not the prevalence of clouds.
Absolutely. And what's really interesting, just to add to that, is there's a scientist called Dr. Andrew Desler, who works in the Texas A&M University. And his findings have been quite shocking, because recently they've discovered that water vapor has a much more amplifying effect of other greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. They didn't think it played much of a role, but recently they've discovered using, I think the satellite is called the NASA Aqua Satellite, which I really like. It's really quite a cool name. And what this device does, it measures humidity within the lowest 10 miles of our atmosphere, and it combines that data with temperature observations and matches that with CO2 observations in the atmosphere. And they've worked out there's a big positive feedback loop between water vapor and greenhouse gas emissions such as carbon dioxide. So that means that even like a small rise of 1.8 Fahrenheit could have huge implications of water vapor amplifying the effects of carbon dioxide, without being too verbose here. So it is a big player, actually.
That doesn't sound like a very positive feedback loop at all. That sounds like a negative feedback loop, if anything.
Yeah. And then we walk into another misconception, positive feedback. Exactly. It's an amplifier, not that it's good for everyone. No, but absolutely. People think the biggest natural, the biggest human induced or anthropogenic greenhouse gas emission, of course, is carbon dioxide. However, there is a bunch of water vapor in atmosphere, which is meant to be there mostly naturally as well. There's your misconception corner of greenhouse gas emissions.
Thank you. It's also crippling anxiety corner.
I forgot about that.
But I really distinctly remember when I was learning about climate change and greenhouse gases, doing my GCSEs, that we were told about, what are they called, chlorofluorocarbons?
Yeah, that's it.
Is that it? CFCs.
Yes.
And how basically the world got together and said, let's ban these and we can stop stop using them in our fridges and stop using them in aerosols. And we did. And there is no problem with the ozone anymore. The hole in the ozone is fixed. Problem solved.
Yeah.
And we didn't learn our lesson that work together to solve the problem. But yeah, I really distinctly remember reading that and then thinking, oh, okay. Like, we've just worked together, problem solved. But yeah, then, of course, you make a lot of money off cows and cars and everything, don't you?
That is true. And also, the idea of global collaboration sometimes can be a little bit fanciful. I don't imagine that if you look at the Sustainable Development Goals that the UN have published in 2015, there's 17 of them. There's 16 of them. And that all global leaders have to go and say, yeah, we want to agree to be able to meet this so we can improve our social progress index, the SPI. But interestingly, the 17th Sustainable Development Goal is, can we just work together? That's literally the 17th one. So they have to agree to collaborate. That's essentially what that is.
Right. And I bet that's the first one that they disagree on, isn't it?
Quite mostly, yeah. But what's also quite good, it holds them accountable to the decisions they make. So, I mean, it kind of does work, but it does kind of make that point. Like, it's really hard to globally collaborate between nations. So they had to put it as part of a sustainable development goal to force nations and global leaders to actually fulfill their commitments to these goals.
Man, it's very 1990s, that kind of thinking, isn't it? Very Cold War's over. Everything's going to be fine from now on. History's finished. We can all just chill out.
History's finished? Thank goodness for that.
There was an author called Francis Fukuyama who wrote a book called The End of History 30 years ago. That went well for him.
Yeah, really. That's well done, that person. Well done him.
Yeah. Should we head into historical misconception corner?
I want to say I've got no say in the matter, but no, generally.
So imagine you've been invited to a Roman dinner and you're eating Roman foods like dormice and other weird things. What else? But they ate a lot of shellfish. They ate a disgusting fish sauce. That's like, have you ever been to a Vietnamese restaurant and had their fish sauce? Of course, you've been to, have you not been to...
I've been to Vietnam, to Vietnam, yeah. I don't remember eating the fish sauce. I remember eating very stinky jackfruit. I think that's the very stinky fruit they have on the side of the road, but no fishy sauce. I did eat sour tome, though, but that was...
Was it fermented by any chance?
I wasn't pissed after, so no.
That you ate off the side of the road.
Yeah.
Can you just tell us the story there a little bit? Because I really sincerely hope you're not literally eating jackfruit off the side of the road.
Well, no, it was from a side market. It wasn't literally picking it up from the floor. Okay. It was an actual market. But when you approach these markets, it's quite funny because they always have the flies all flying around them. It looks very unhygienic, but actually it's just been freshly picked that day. And if you just give it a wash, it's all right. And they wash it there in front of you as well with their tap water. Yeah, okay, let's not go down that line.
Let's not tell the story of your flesh-eating bacteria that you know.
Let's not do that one. Let's go back to this conception corner. I'm eating food.
Yeah, exactly. And you've eaten a little bit too much. Where do you go?
You're going to go to the vomitorium, surely.
That's the misconception. No, you're not.
Why not?
Because Romans wouldn't do that.
Why not? That's what it's there for. The word vomits in it.
I mean, that's what you'd think. But if you actually think about it for a second, what you're saying is that the Roman society had such a problem with binge eating that they would build a specific room in their house, a specific room for throwing up, not a toilet, a specific throwing up room.
I'm sorry. It might be insane, but if there was a civilization that was capable of doing it, it is going to be the Romans, surely.
True. But then, I mean, obesity rates in some modern countries are over 50%, and we don't have vomitoria today. Except we do, because that's not what a vomitorium is. A vomitorium is actually is you love your football. You've got your Gilliam shirts behind you. Yeah. When you go to the football, you go up the stairs and you go through a big, what do you call the kind of gateway entrance thing in the stands of a stadium?
I know what you mean. Like I would just call it the entrance. I don't think of it. I haven't got a name for it as such. Maybe there is one.
Do you want a name for it?
Is it vomitorium?
It's a vomitorium. No. That is a vomitorium.
Really? That's a vomitorium?
Yeah, it is.
What?
Because what it does is it spews out people into the terraces.
So it's quite literal in the sense that it is... But I'm sorry. For this to work, though, as a vomitorium, the stadium would have had to have consumed the people first to spit them back out.
Well,
is that right?
I mean...
Am I picking holes in their definition a little bit? I feel like I might have done so.
But if you think about it, like the stadium in the round's a little bit like a great big gut.
And
you're coming through a very narrow entrance that's a little bit like an esophagus.
Yeah, that's true.
A little bit.
And I've been to a few games at Duisburg and there is a lot of vomit around there sometimes, I have to say.
There's a lot of vomitoria going on there.
Yeah, huge amounts.
No, that's what a vomitorium is. It comes from the Latin word vomo, which means to spew.
Oh my God. It's horrific.
And the idea behind it was exactly the same as in modern stadia. It's to get people in and out as fast as possible. And so that's what a vomitorium is. It's the entranceway into the terraces of a stadium. Nothing to do with eating too much food whatsoever. The Romans simply, well, if they did do that, they didn't do it on a society-wide level at all.
So it's just more of a convenience that actually the word vomit is in there, and it's a nice story because we know Romans probably overate and indulged so much
that
it's just a convenient story which has become part of people's misconceived knowledge.
Yeah, exactly. It's, I mean, it is the classic misconception. Yeah, it is very much so. But it gets us onto the topic of the Roman games, and that's what my theme is this week, is the games, not Roman games, but the games
exciting.
That people play. And my favorite fact about the Roman games is once you get into the Eastern Roman Empire, so the Byzantine Empire, which they call themselves Romans, but they don't even have control of Rome anymore. They're based in Constantinople, which is Istanbul today. Mm-hmm. And there, the games, specifically the chariot games, get so massive that it turns into a genuine threat to public safety.
Oh my God.
Because there are two teams in Byzantium, the Greens and the Blues. That's what they were called, the Greens and the Blues, because they wore green uniforms and blue uniforms. They're not very creative with their ideas.
That's not very creative.
Not at all, but they became so popular that the games were a political event, similar to how modern sporting events, like the Rugby World Cup's going on at the moment, and you will see the French president popping up every now and then, and you'll see Prince William or dignitaries and politicians popping up to turn it into a political event. Exactly the same thing 1,500 years ago, except these games got really violent. And if the Greens won, then the supporters of the Greens would go around just trashing blue parts of town and vice versa. And it got to the point where if the two sides ever united and rioted, then they could probably overthrow the emperor. And they almost did in 532.
Oh
my God.
It'd
be like if Millwall and West Ham stopped fighting each other and just overthrew the Houses of Parliament. It's proper civil war from the chariot games.
That makes me feel sick.
Well, good thing you're off to the vomitorium tomorrow.
Right?
Yeah. And even things like sports washing, we think it's a new thing in sport. It's not. The emperors would put on games in order to keep people happy and shut them up about the terrible taxes and the terrible times and things like that. So Roman games, very, very similar to our games, even down to the vomitoria.
I have to say, one of the, this sports washing is happening, I think, in Saudi Arabia significantly at the moment. Not to touch on that too much, but actually, one of the things I like about sport, and I think we might have mentioned this before, is that it's always better to have cultural battles in that context rather than physical war battles on the field, and where there's deaths and all that kind of stuff. But actually, it's much better to be chanting that you've won a game of football against another country and then that's it, rather than you've actually gone to war with another country and lost half of your troops.
Yeah, exactly. And this is what I find so interesting about, I mean, like the Rugby World Cup that's going on. I'm a big rugby fan, but you aren't particularly, are you?
I will watch it when I can. I'm more excited, for example, the Ryder Cup that's starting today.
I could not be less interested in televised golf.
Yeah.
Like, you could do anything to jazz it up. You could set the balls on fire. You could put crocodiles on the greens. You could give them, like, you could set the players on fire. You could make them drunk to play.
I think that's nothing how they play in Florida, actually.
Is that? Well, maybe I should watch then.
Shall we go to the main part?
Let's go.
So I've given, you'll like this one. So I've given the title of this one, and I want to see what, and I know you like this poet author, but I've given the title of this one, The Solar Visions from Innocence to Experience.
Ew.
And I kind of felt like it was a very William Blake approach to a title.
It is very William Blake, exactly.
Yeah, I thought you might appreciate that one. Anyway, what we are, I'm going to kind of sort of go through, not say a story, but this is a very recent kind of event that's happening over in the States. And it's linked to essentially solar panels. But I'm going to set the scene. So you know where the Mojave Desert is?
Yeah, I always thought it was called the Mojave Desert because I'm an idiot. It's Southern California, isn't it?
Correct. Yeah. So it's in the south. We look at the southwest of America in a more broader term. But yes, it's it starts in California, have the Mojave winds and so on. Yeah. So the Mojave Desert has been witnessing recently a rise in solar farms, which while beneficial for clean energy, of course, has raised environmental concerns. Now, do you know what iconic tree is amongst the Mojave Desert and that part of the States?
Yeah, it's also my favorite U2 album. It's the Joshua Tree.
Oh, well done. Very good. Good synapse clashing there.
Thank you.
Yeah, it is the Joshua Tree. But the iconic Joshua trees are being removed for these projects. And these solar farms sometimes take up valuable agricultural land, disrupting local ecosystems. I think we talked about lizards before in this area, I think, once.
Yeah, we did. The skinks and the eyeless weasels and that kind of thing.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, so these guys live in these areas as well. But in sort of linked to this, I mean, 2021, President Joe Biden emphasized the importance of solar energy in the US's goal to achieve net zero greenhouse gas emissions by 2050, which for me is very ambitious for the States, considering it is a car-centric nation. It is very ambitious, but is there? I don't think Biden would be alive by that point either. Sorry to say,
but, I don't think he'll be alive by 2024.
Probably not. No. However, most of these solar installations are in rural areas, which can alter natural landscapes and require extensive transmission lines. So it can become a little bit pricey in some respects. But there's a potential solution to this. So it's beginning to rise recently that in parts of Southwest America, they are using parking lots or car parks for solar installations, which is
a great idea.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I saw one of these the other day where it was outside a government office here where they put up awnings over the parking lot that was solar powered, and then you could plug your car into the awning.
It's
brilliant idea.
Such a good idea. So these parking lots, so firstly, this statistic, for me, I don't know, I found this incredible. I want to see what you think of this. So parking lots, which cover over 5% of the developed land of the United States.
I mean, I tell you what, whenever I'm feeling a little bit glum, one of my favorite things to do is go on YouTube and watch videos of Europeans laughing at how badly sorted out American logistics are, because I'm that kind of nerd.
Right, of course.
So it doesn't come as a complete surprise, but it also comes as a 5%.
Yeah.
That's ridiculous.
Yeah, so 5% of developed land in the States are car parks, which is unbelievable. So the Americans there are starting with, especially in the Southwest, are starting to see this as a potential opportunity. So by installing solar panel canopies over these lots, we can harness solar energy without causing additional environmental disruption in rural areas in the Mojave Desert, for example. Now, your favorite country, like France, I have to say, bonjour, and all that. That's a little bit my French.
Yeah, pretty good.
I can say I'm a rubber in French.
Why?
I don't know. It's just sweet on gomme.
Yeah, correct. Why?
I don't know. I can say it's just sweet on petit déjeuner as well. That's it. That is my French limit. I don't know why I can say
that.
Do
you work
things.
In a very specific French brothel?
Yeah, well, so, I was in a restaurant that had to dress up as a rubber and serve breakfast. So, yeah, that was my. That's very, very niche restaurant in the south of France. Let's not talk
about
that.
Were you one of those sushi girls that they have at fancy parties?
Exactly. One of those, yeah. Had to get my hair sorted every morning. It was a nightmare. Anyway, so France are already implementing policies to promote this, requiring significant portions of outdoor parking areas to be covered with solar canopies, which is, again, a great idea. Now, with these canopies, they might be more expensive than the traditional solar farms. But here's the thing, and this is a really important thing with people that invest money in renewable energy, is there's something called a lag time. The reason that a lot of solar farms and a lot of wind turbines or wind farms are very unattractive to investors is because the payback time is significantly long. So that's the lag time. Investors like quick turnaround and quick buck, essentially. However, green energy and renewable energy doesn't offer that as an option. And it's always a relatively long lag time to get your investment back. However, it does become profitable, let's say in 20, 30, 40 years' time. You need to have an investor that is prepared to see that vision, not necessarily for him to reap the rewards, but either the generation around him and also the people around him with a greener energy. And that's usually one of the big issues with investments in renewable energies.
That's you're relying on, market finance is entirely about short-term gain. And so you're relying on somebody, like the best people at it have the shortest term vision. Yeah. So it's very, very rare. Yeah, not going
to
happen.
So you have to obviously rely on subsidies and governments to get involved to be able to actually get these products to life. But to put a few more figures on this from the States, so a typical Walmart supercenter has a 5-acre parking lot. And if equipped with a solar canopy, it could support a 3-megawatt solar array. Now, this is all probably just number jargon to you, but I'll put it into context. Mm-hmm. So if Walmart implemented this across all their roughly 3,500 stores across the US, the total capacity would be 11.1 gigawatts of solar power, which is roughly equivalent to a dozen large coal fire power plants.
Right. So that's substantial.
Hugely substantial. You know, that's 11 coal plants if you covered every Walmart car park with the solar panels. Yeah.
And that is dead space. And also presumably because the solar panels are at least absorbing some of the solar energy, otherwise it wouldn't work, then that energy isn't going into the tarmac, isn't being reflected back. And so there's a little bit of benefit there.
You say a little bit, a huge benefit, because not only is it making it attractive for people to park their cars because it's cooler underneath, but also it means you don't have to use as much energy to cool the building itself because it's taken a lot by the solar energy. So you haven't got to put the AC on as high. So it's like it's hugely beneficial to implement this sort of management strategy to produce green energy. But we also kind of talked about just Walmart, but several US institutions like airports and university are already exploring the potential of solar parking lots. And we've seen how big car parks are in airports. They're massive. Mm-hmm. They're huge. Mm-hmm. So this is a definite opportunity that we are not we're actually just doubling up on the space that we're already using. And as you've already said, it's like dead space. So this is a great opportunity for that to be explored. This is where I get really frustrated with this kind of thing. Well, luckily for us, actually, what I'm about to say now, it kind of backs up not putting solar arrays in the desert. But have you heard of the idea of NIMBY or NIMBYism?
Yeah. So not in my backyard.
Exactly. Now, there's an example where in the American Southwest, there's a place called Mormon Mesa in Nevada. Now, there was a proposal to build a battle-borne solar project, it was called, which would have been the largest solar power plant in the US. However, even though this project would have been out of sight from nearby towns, it faced strong opposition from the local community. Now, the opposition formed a group called Save Our Mesa. Mesa, I think, is it Latin for like table? I think it comes from that. And also...
Mensa is table with N.
Ah, is it Mensa?
Not quite, but I know it's the kind of classic Wild West flat-topped rock,
yes,
isn't it?
That's it. Yeah. So because you get like a plateau and then you get like a mesa as well, which is like a tabletop feature in the desert. So I think that's probably what that's linked to. But that was what they called Save Our Mesa. Anyway, so their main concern was that such a large solar installation would be an eyesore and disrupt popular recreational activities and deter tourists from visiting local attractions. Now,
How many people are going to the Nevadan desert to visit Mormon Mesa?
Well, exactly. And this is what I thought. It depends on how small this community is and if it solely 100% relies on its tourism to be able to create its very small local economy. And that's what they argued, essentially. And as a result, they won and the whole project was abandoned as a result.
Well, come on.
And this is the problem I have, is that it even says in the article, they're very much behind renewable energy, but we don't want it to ruin, we want the policymakers to consider local communities. I'm like, this is the classic NIMBYism. Like, it's generally textbook NIMBYism. Like,
it is. Yeah, we need this to happen, but not around here, please.
Yeah.
I mean, the Mormons are weird. At the risk of being banned from Utah, which I'm never going to go to anyway. And that doesn't surprise me, because their whole idea is that the chosen land, Israel, is the Wild West. And the Jews were actually Native Americans. And so, of course, they're not going to give up their mesa because it was given to them by God. Yeah, weird.
And the fact that you've called Nevadans from Utah, that's two states off the tick list now.
What on earth have I got to do in Nevada? Of all the people in the world, I think I'm literally last on the list of people who would survive 10 minutes in Las Vegas.
Yeah, that's a fair point. Yeah. I'd love you to walk through Las Vegas. That'd be very fun, because I think you would be really annoyed that you are there.
I would hate it. I would hate it with a burning passion. One of my heroes is a little dwarf fella called Benjamin Lay, who would go around just yelling at people in the street because they were helping slavery by buying clothes made by slaves. And I would immediately turn into him, just yelling at people. What are you doing? This is meant to be a desert. Why is there this here? Is it? Stop it. Stop gambling. Oh my God.
Oh. So he's... because it is the city that shouldn't exist. Yeah,
exactly. I feel insulted personally by the existence of Las Vegas. Their tagline should be an affront to God and man. I hate the idea of Las Vegas.
But Will, you could get married there by Elvis.
He's dead. Just like Las Vegas should be. What a disgusting thing. Nothing good has ever come from Las Vegas.
Can I rein you in and go full circle and entice you back to a poem that ChatGPT has written for me in the style, well, not of William Blake, but I hoped it was. But it's written a poem about the Mojave Desert and the solar panels. Can I read it to you?
Excellent. Of course.
Okay, so here we go. So it goes like this. So... how would Jason would have a microphone? He'd be
yelling.
Yeah, that's true. I'm not going to yell.
No.
So here we go.
Poor Chris.
So in Mojave's sun-kissed land so wide, Joshua trees took a solar-powered ride. Clean energy's great, they all did cheer. But not in my backyard, some did jeer. Biden had a plan, bold and neat. Net zero emissions, quite the feat. But solar panels in rural sprawl, the idea didn't charm all. Then a scientist thought, with a grin so sly, why not the parking lots? Oh my, Walmart's vast lots under the sun's glare could be solar hubs beyond compare. Save our mesa, cried a group so loud. We love solar, but not that crowd. The science persists with a demo so grand, solar canopies across the land. A parking lot gleaming and bright became the star in everyone's sight. Funny how solutions, once so aloof, can be found atop our car's roof. So that's good, right?
That's good.
So here's to the sun and ideas so zany. Turning parking lots to energy, ain't that brainy? In the quest for clean, let's not be snooty. Harness the sun and do our duty.
Nice. Well done, ChatGPT. Nice.
Yeah. And I think I will end on that.
Wonderful. cool. Right. Let me tell you about... What were you going to say?
Yeah, go on. Go again now. I'm ready.
Okay. You sure?
I am. I was
strapped
in. I'm banging the side of my chair. That means I'm ready.
You are. You're like a like a big baby who sees the food coming. Like,
that's it. That is exactly what it is. That's what I do that still.
We're ready to munch. Mm-hmm. Let me tell you about the Mechanical Turk.
What?
I like my women like I like my Turks. Mechanical. Oh, God.
That really made me laugh. Yes.
Sorry, Veronica. Say so she's not Mackay, she's real.
I was going to say.
She's real, just to confirm.
Okay, right.
Although not for long, if I carry on.
No,
like
I
that.
Think you're going to have the... Oh, dear Lord. Oh, dear. Okay.
Right. So, in 1770, a fellow called Wolfgang von Kempelen, who was an inventor, and you know that he's mental because his job was inventor.
Yeah, of course.
He went to the Schönbrunn Palace in Vienna, and he saw a trickster, a magician, doing his magic in the palace, and he thought, I want to get in on some of this. I'm going to invent something magical. I'm going to do something ridiculous that takes the world by storm. And so he heads off back to his workshop, and he appears a few years later with the Mechanical Turk. The Mechanical Turk is a cabinet about the size of a dining table, and on the top it's got a chessboard, and sat behind the table is a big wooden automaton, a big robot made out of wood,
okay,
carved to look like a big Turk. So he's got a classic onion-shaped hat. He's got these great luxurious robes. He's got an enormous pipe in one hand that's kind of 2 meters long, mm-hmm, that belches out smoke. And he's got another hand that can move and can pick up the chess pieces and that can play chess.
That's
the Mechanical Turk.
Incredible. Now, I'm already excited to see what happens here. That's, you know... Because for what it's worth, listener, Will did get me into chess properly as an adult. I did play as a child, but not, you know, mm-hmm, and then Will managed a few years ago to get me back into chess. I haven't picked up recently, but mm-hmm, this story might change that. I'm looking forward
to
this.
It might do, yeah. I started replaying recently because I now run the chess club.
And, of course you do.
It's all 11-year-old boys who are absolutely mints in about 5 moves. It's fantastic for my self-esteem.
Excellent.
Recommend it.
Excellent. So you're just bullying on the schoolyard, essentially, that?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, exactly. Just going to pause because Frida's on the cat. Oi, get down. That's not where cats live. Oh, give me a sec. Get down. Thank you, you little shit. Right, edit that out. So,
no, I might keep that in somewhere along the line. I think just for everyone's reference, if you did that, Frida is not Will's wife. That is
no, that's Veronica. Just to be clear, she's loud on the counter whenever she wants.
So, anyway, it's this guy with this guy with the mechanical chessboard.
Yeah, the Mechanical Turk. Yeah, and it's enormous. Yeah, like I said, it's the size of a dining table, and the wooden Turk is life size. And the thing is, nobody could figure out how on earth it worked. It played chess to a really, really high level. As we'll see in a bit, it beats more or less everyone it plays. And it can also complete something called the Knight's Tour, which is, as you know, knights in chess move in a bit of a weird way. They go up 2 squares and they go left or right 1 square in an L shape. And there's a specific puzzle where get a blank chessboard and put a knight on any of the squares and then get it to move round so that it lands on every single square once and only once before it gets back to where it started. Really? Right. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I've got that. Yeah, no, that one's, yeah, absolutely.
It's a little bit complicated, but that's kind of the point. It's super, super tricky to figure it out how it works. And the Mechanical Turk could do it in like 2 minutes. Just whiz round, bing, bang, bong, job done.
That's mad.
Yeah. So Okay. He takes it, first of all, to Schönbrunn, because that's where he was, first of all, got the idea to create something magical. And he shows it to Empress Teresa, Maria Teresa, sorry, who was Marie Antoinette's mum, so okay. 1770s. And she's fascinated by it, and she wants to look inside it. And so he says, yeah, absolutely, open up all the cabinet doors. There's nothing underneath the Turk. Ooh. To the left, underneath, if you imagine it like a table, two-thirds of it are completely empty, and the other third of it is full of levers and cogs and pistons and whirring mechanisms and all kinds of magical gizmos, and they're connected by levers to the chessboard. Ooh. That then moves the chess pieces around.
That's impressive.
So there's some kind of magical mechanism going on in there. That's, but none of the engineers who looked at it could figure out what the mechanism actually is, what's it actually doing.
So far, what you've kind of built this up, an inventor who is not an engineer has come up with a magic trick, essentially, that he's kind of deceiving people, potentially. That seems like...
Well, except... No one can figure out what's going on at all.
Okay.
And therefore, the most obvious answer is the correct answer, which is that it's magic.
He's actually invented magic.
He's actually invented magic here, yeah. And so the first person who ever played against the Mechanical Turk was beaten in about 30 minutes.
Okay.
It didn't take him too long. And the interesting thing is that the next person to be played tried to make an illegal move to see what would happen.
Right.
So moving a pawn three squares forward, say, or moving the queen like a knight. And what the Turk did is it moved its wooden hand and it picked up the piece that was moved illegally, and then it put it back to where it had come from, and then it took its own move.
Oh, wow.
So it
okay.
knew the rules, and it knew what to do if the rules were broken as well.
So this guy is invented Stockfish. Essentially.
Yeah, exactly. He has exactly invented a chess engine before computers were invented.
What a don.
And so people are saying to Kempelen, take this all over Europe. This is crazy. You've got something here that no one's ever seen before. And Kempelen said, Nah, I'd rather build boxes that can talk. And so he trashed chucked it in
what?
The bin.
It just threw it away.
What's
the point of doing all that hard work to make something made of magic to then not show anyone? Did he not like touring? He just liked to. He made things literally for the sake of making things, and that's it.
Yeah, I mean, to remind you, he was an inventor, and therefore he was crazy.
Oh yeah,
because no one calls himself an inventor without being absolutely barmy.
But, I like it when they go onto Dragon's Den or the Shark's Tank, and then I'm an inventor. And I go, oh, you're mental. I get it. Okay.
Yeah. I've invented a new way to peel eggs. Why?
Yeah. Well, you're solving problems that don't exist. Get out of it.
Exactly. So only one person plays against the Turk for the next 10 years before it's binned. And then in 1781, the emperor who succeeds Empress Maria Theresa, who's called Joseph, goes to Kempelen and says, you've got to rebuild this thing because I want to show it off to the Russians.
Right.
And so if you don't rebuild it, this is a diplomatic nightmare. So go and rebuild it. So he does. And he takes it back to Vienna and he shows it to the Russians, to Grand Duke Paul, who would go on to be Tsar Paul. And Tsar Paul says to him, look, you have to take this around all of Europe because everybody is going to be driven completely crazy by it. This is ridiculous. No, what's going on here?
Yeah.
And so Kempelen says, yeah, all right, fine. I guess I've got to.
So,
and takes, yeah.
This is the thing, isn't it? Like, we've talked about people that go on these tours. Well, we did one in America where they took the head. You talk about headless chicken, Mike, the headless chicken.
Mike, the headless chicken goes on tour. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is a lot. Mike, the headless chicken was a lot later, but the idea that this is an economy is still amazing to me. But of course it is. It's just a tertiary industry. It's entertainment. So, of course, there's like. It's an
this
economy
is Twitch
in this.
Streaming.
Yeah.
This is, yeah. I mean, the world before television is a bit kind of turning into as much a constant theme on here as Bangladesh is.
Yeah.
And you can take that off on your Gik bingo card there.
Yeah, it's just Bangladesh. And yeah. Well, two at once now, if it's life before television is our other main one now.
Yes, absolutely. But what a weird world to live in. Nothing to do. Do you want to go and see a magical wooden chess playing box? What else am I going to do? Stare at the wall again for the next 6 hours?
Well, Rasputin,
we've already done that today.
Rasputin was already looking at some silver crosses from last week, I think.
Yeah. So the Turk is taken to Paris, and of course it's taken to Versailles, and it dazzles everyone in Versailles and beats everyone. And then it's taken into the center of Paris, where it plays a guy called Philidor. Mm. Philidor's a name you might remember from when you were playing chess. Does it ring a bell?
It does. That name does ring a bell. That's all I can, I just know it links to chess. That is literally all I know from that.
So Philidor's one of the great figures of chess history. He's you've got a couple of people in the 15th and 16th century who kind of invented the modern game, and then Philidor was the first of the modern chess players, really. Mm-hmm. So he's like, I don't know, Jimi Hendrix of chess.
Okay.
So he kind of lays down the law for what's going to come next, or the Bach of chess.
Is he left-handed as well?
He's not left-handed, no. And not quite as good as the guitar, but Philidor plays, so he's the best chess player in the world. This is before they've got the World Chess Championships, but there is no doubt that Philidor is the best chess player in the world. And he plays against the Turk. And it's a long, grueling game, and both the Philidor's starting to sweat and getting really deep into the pain cave and kind of, am I going to be able to beat this thing? And eventually Philidor does manage to beat the Turk, but he says afterwards, that was the hardest game of chess I've ever played. I've never been so exhausted in my life.
Okay. So
pretty impressive thing, isn't it?
It is. Now this, I'm just trying to work out though. Now there's a real side of me that's like, this isn't okay. Is it magic? No, I know it's not magic. So,
unless
it is, no, it's not magic. Unless it is magic, but it isn't. No,
but it could be.
No, I think the reasonable side of me. So, who's the guy again that's invented this? What's his name?
Kempelen.
So he's
Wolfgang
either
von Kempelen.
So he's either playing this himself, and he's just like a secret grandmaster or something that can just play chess, and he's manipulating the machine in some way to be able to play it without anyone noticing. That's the only way I can imagine it at the moment.
Well, he would stay kind of next to the Turk the whole time. And what he would do is he had a little wooden box that was in the size of a baby's coffin and the shape of a baby's coffin.
Right.
And he put it on top of it. He could take it off and put it on top of the table. And no one else was allowed to look into it. And he would spend the whole time that the game was going on opening the lid of the box, looking, peering really close up to it, muttering into it, and then closing the lid of the box and making sure no one could see what he was doing.
Okay.
But he could take this box off completely and carry it around with him. It wasn't connected in any way to the table.
Still,
so he's just talking into this mysterious box.
Still, that's a bit sus.
It is a bit sus. Except, I mean, how is it sus? What could the box possibly be doing?
I don't know.
Other than communicating messages to the spirit world that are then picked up by this magical Turk.
Has he come from the future? Has he brought back, like, has he gone to like the year 2200 and has invented the 1700s?
I'm glad that that's where we're at with the logical process here.
Yeah, it fell apart very quickly. Maybe
I don't know if I'm going to make you believe in magic, but I'm going to do my best to try, because that's what people thought. They thought that this was magic, and people, this little box that Kempelen had, people were terrified of it. People thought that it contained spirits, that it contained some kind of message transmitting system to the spirit world. Some women, when they saw the box, were reported to immediately leave the room and just get as far away from it as possible because of the bad vibes coming off it. So who knows what's going on? But either way, so Philidor manages to beat the Turk, but no one else does. Benjamin Franklin plays against the Turk in Paris and is beaten like almost immediately, like 20 minutes, just thrashed. And so the Turk carries on this tour. It goes to London, comes back over to the continent and goes to Leipzig and then Dresden and then Amsterdam. And then it ends up in Sanssouci, which is in Potsdam, so just south of Berlin, where Frederick the Great has his court. And then it kind of disappears for about 10 years before a guy called Melzel buys it. And he takes it off again to Schönbrunn, where in 1809, it meets Napoleon Bonaparte.
Aha.
And Napoleon Bonaparte and the Turk have a bit of a confrontation, because we've spoken about Napoleon before, haven't we? Exactly. I mean, he's such an arse of a man. But what I do genuinely quite respect about him is the fact that when he sees a limit, he will push it and he will break it and he will see what happens. And that's just how his mind works. And so that's exactly what he does with the Turk. He's the first person to see the Turk to think, all right, game on. Let's see what happens when I break it.
Of course it's game on. Absolutely. It's Napoleon. Of course it's going to be game on. I think this is the end of the road for this chess machine.
Well, how Napoleon decides to test it is he makes an illegal move. He makes the queen move like a knight.
Okay.
So he picks it up, forward two spaces, left one space, and then puts it down. And we know that if this happens, the Turk has the procedure built into it.
Yep.
It will pick up the piece and it will return it to where it came from and then take a move. And so Napoleon does exactly the same thing again. Picks up the queen, moves it like a knight. Mm-hmm. And so the Turk picks up the queen and drops it off the side of the board.
Ooh.
You're not having your queen anymore.
Ooh,
and so Napoleon starts to smirk and picks up another piece. I think it might be the king, and moves that like a knight. And the Turk just smashes all the pieces off the board. Nope, we're not doing that. And Napoleon bursts out laughing.
Okay.
Brilliant.
Okay.
Excellent. So that's how we're going to play.
So that's the most Napoleon thing, apart from losing a war with bunnies. That's the only other time I really enjoyed.
Exactly. Yeah, it is. And I would love to see, I don't think this is going to be in the upcoming Napoleon film, but I'd love to see a filmed version of this where you've just like a shot of Napoleon smirking and then back to the mechanical Turk, not making any face at all because it's wooden.
Yes.
And then back to Napoleon, then back to the Turk. And it's such a great scene to picture in your mind, that.
Oh.
And so Napoleon says, all right, fine. Look, let's play a real game here. Let's see how good this Turk is at chess. Because Napoleon was good at chess. He was a renowned chess player. And for his time, he was considered not kind of top three in the world, but certainly up there with professional chess players of the time.
Wow. Okay.
Turk beats him in 19 moves.
Ooh.
Bing, bang, bong, job done. Thrashed.
I bet he wasn't too pleased.
And so Napoleon, he was not happy with this. And he said, all right, I think I know what's going on here. And he gets a scarf and he ties it around the Turk's eyes so that the wooden automaton can't see what's going on, and then loses in about 25 moves.
Right.
So Napoleon says, all right, nah, whatever. Not having any more of this. I'm going to go and kill some Russians instead.
So, okay. So what I want you to reveal, you're going to reveal what's actually happening, or has it been a mystery to this day?
Well, the thing is, so it carries on having a history up until 1854, when it's destroyed in a fire in Philadelphia. And for its entire lifetime, nobody had any idea what was going on. It was a complete mystery. And people took it apart. They had a look at it. When the games were going on, they opened all the cabinets. They could see that when a move was being made, there was a great big whirring noise, like a clockwork sound. But nobody knew at all what was going on until it ended up in Philadelphia before it burnt down, and people could really take a good look inside it without the owner being there, because the owner by that point had died. Medzel, the guy who bought it off Kempelen, had died.
Right.
And it turns out that what was actually going on was there was just a little person inside it who was really good at chess.
So there was a tiny person that was very good at chess, making all the moves.
Just a little guy inside it the whole time. He's really good at chess.
Oh.
Like, he had a board underneath. There were magnets relaying the moves from the top board to the bottom board, so he could see what was going on. And then he had a second board which had pegs on it, and he could move a lever around that was connected to the arm. So as he moves the lever backwards and forwards, the arm goes backwards and forwards. And as he turns the lever, twists it, the hand would go down and pick up and then release.
Oh, I see. So I have to say though,
it's very simple.
But also, that's a pretty tricky thing to invent anyway. Like to,
it is.
Like that's quite, yeah. And to operate as well, under pressure of playing Napoleon as well. Like,
exactly. Like that's
fair play to the little man.
It's a seriously impressive thing. Absolutely. Yeah. But it is just, it's the most obvious answer. It's just a little fella.
Small person. Do you know what? I love
just
the
small guy.
I love the idea is when this little guy was playing against Napoleon the first time around, he was making all the illegal moves. He must have felt quite good to smash the board in front of Napoleon.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, take this.
Yeah, take this. You don't know who I am and you never will. I love that idea.
So there's just two unanswered questions, which is number one, what does the magical box do that Kempelen was talking into?
Yes.
And number two, how could people look inside whilst the game was going on and not see that there was someone in it?
Well, that's my question, because I thought you said they opened up all of the cabinets, so surely someone was able to see.
So, yeah.
So what's going on there?
Well, what's going on there? And this might be my favourite detail of all of the Mechanical Turk, is he was sat on a little stool that had wheels on it. And so when they open one door, he just wheel over to one side of the cabinet. And then when they open the next, he just wheel back.
Did no one think to open both the doors at the same time?
He's just a little fella on a stool with wheels. Just zooming around the inside of this cabinet, playing massively impressive games of chess.
That's incredible. This is so mental. Of course, this guy who's an inventor. That's mental. That he genuinely is a mentalist. But it works.
He just turns up at breakfast one day and his wife says, "Wolfgang, you got that look in your eyes again." All right, just don't tell me, but just tell me what I need to go and get for you. All right, well, I'm going to need about 3 trees worth of wood and a dwarf who's really good at chess.
I mean, I don't know. I think the former's easier to find in that list.
the final question, what does the magical box do that he would mutter into? Mm. Do you want to guess?
I want to, is it a way to communicate what move? No, because he can't see the board. Is it the move that Napoleon has done? I don't know in this example.
No, because he can see the board because it's connected. He's got the little chess playing fella inside has got a second board that's connected by magnets.
Okay, so
he can see everything.
So my second guess is it a decoy of some description?
Yeah, don't do anything.
It doesn't do a thing. It's a massive decoy. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just, I know what will really freak these people out. If I have a baby-sized coffin that I talk into whilst we're playing chess, don't do anything at all.
That's like, do you know when if you're in a group of friends, let's say I used to at university, it's 4 of us playing a card game, and then a fifth one wanted to join, and we'd stop what we're playing secretly, and then we would make up a game on the go, and always make that fifth player lose of not knowing why, and then having in-jokes that didn't really exist. So it's that kind of attitude that seems to have got him through this chess invention.
Exactly, exactly. And it's exactly how magic works.
Yeah.
All you need to do is, I mean, like, cup your hands and say, "Look, I got something here." You can't see it, but it's pretty special. And there's something in our brain that just makes us go, "Ooh, I wonder what's in there."
Exactly.
It's, you just trick people into believing that what cannot possibly be true is the only reasonable solution. And that is what magic is. It does exist, except it's just a trick of the mind.
Fantastic.
I love the story of the Mechanical Turk. It's just a little fella in there.
That is brilliant. The last detail of this is that it went through, it seems to be like, centuries. Did they have to keep finding little men that were good at chess? Because obviously,
it's like,
what kind of job advert is that?
Just need a constant supply of small people who don't have claustrophobia and are amongst the best chess players in the world that no one knows about.
That is the nichest market if I ever heard one. And wow.
So that's the Mechanical Turk.
Rob, I am pleasantly happy to have heard that. Thank you. Whew. Okay, we've made it all the way to number time, Will.
We have indeed. Here we are. What a What a scene it is. What a view. What a vista.
It is. It's a vista. Nice. Nice word. I've not heard that in a while. Good use of the word vista.
Pop that down on your bingo card. Will uses mildly impressive vocabulary.
There's a good word that I use. It's a weird context word, but I managed to use the word obsequious recently during the week, which I thought was
excellent.
Which I thought was a great word to use. So that was my word of the week, and vista is now going to be the word of the weekend. Anyway, so I suppose you want a number and a thing, don't you?
Yeah, I'd appreciate that.
Yeah, so the number is the small number of 400,000. And the clue is the Masjid al-Haram, Mecca.
Masjid al-Haram in Mecca, 400,000. Masjid, M-A-S-J-I-D.
Yes, that's it. Yeah, that's it.
Right, which means mosque, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Al-Haram. Haram means banned by Sharia law.
Okay.
So is this mosque for people who... Can you fit 400,000 pigs in this mosque?
No is the answer to that. You know what this is, don't you? You know what we're referring to in Mecca? Are you...
Yeah, the pilgrimage site for Muslims in Saudi Arabia.
The big black cube.
Yeah.
Yeah, so...
Oh, okay. So in the middle of the big mosque, which has got like a lump of meteorite or something embedded in it, doesn't it?
Something like that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's 400,000 and that. Would you like the extra clue?
Yeah.
The extra clue is Google Maps.
Oh, well, that's a left turn of the traffic lights. I'm thinking
really
400,000 people.
Well, stick with that idea to a certain extent.
Okay. Does it have 400,000 reviews on Google Maps?
Absolutely.
Okay, and so my follow-up question is, of course, what's its rating?
So this is brilliant.
2 stars.
So the basically Mecca, the Masjid al-Haram, the big black cube that sits in there is the highest reviewed, highest or the most reviewed place on Google Maps with over 400,000 reviews, and it has a very impressive 4.9 star rating, which is pretty good, I think.
But why? That is absolutely insane.
Yeah.
Why would you rate it?
So this is really interesting, because you would think either it's going to be something like a museum, a restaurant, or even a business that would dominate this kind of thing. But actually, globally, the highest rated things on Google Maps are landmarks. So the Trevi Fountain in Rome has like over 300,000 reviews. The Eiffel Tower, the same. And the Gateway of India in Mumbai also has roughly about 300 or so thousand reviews. But it's the Masjid al-Haram steamrolls it with 400. Is that 400 currently? I checked yesterday. 402,000 reviews on Google. And it's predicted to keep going up and up and up. And it's soon to exceed like 500,000 reviews, which is insane amount of reviews. Just to give a little bit of context. So the reason that it received so much attention, this mosque, and it's not just the largest globally, but it is of paramount importance to the Muslim religion, and it sees an influx of over 2 million visitors annually, and the mosque capacity is such that it can accommodate up to 4 million people or worshippers simultaneously. Like, it's mental.
Wow.
Like, it's insane.
Wow.
Now, I read somewhere that in Mecca you have to be of the Islam religion to be able to be in Mecca. You can't If you're not, you,
you can't go in if you're not a Muslim.
Yeah, you get told to leave. It's quite a short number of time, this, but because it receives so many millions of visitors each year, you can, that means actually, we look at all the visitors, that's 2 million annually. It's getting probably reviews like every 30 seconds or something like that, I can imagine.
Crazy.
But
why?
Well, this is the thing. I wonder if the article I read about this actually alludes to the fact that you don't have to go somewhere to leave a review as well.
Right.
So it could be Muslims, like, just as a way of having a connection to Mecca. This might be one way to do it. I don't know.
That is so true, because it's one of the five pillars of Islam is the Hajj, the pilgrimage. Muslims have to do it in their lifetime.
Yeah.
And unless they have a very specific reason why they can't.
Yeah. It's like jury duty.
Yes, it is. It is. It's like jury duty. You're going to Blackpool.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, you got to do it once. But is that the kind of... I just hope that there aren't Muslims thinking, well, I can't go because for whatever reason, but I'll do the next best thing, and that's give it 5 stars on Google Maps.
Well, here we go.
Done my part there, haven't I?
I've ripped off 3 reviews from Google.
Wonderful. I so hoped you had.
I've ripped off 3. So I'll leave. You have to guess what star they've given it. Okay, when I read it out.
Okay. Okay. Excellent.
So this is a review from Tama Elminshawi. And he says, ratings are for things or places which can be compared to others, but priceless places are far away to be rated. Who can rate Al-Mashad Al-Baram?
See, I mean, there is something very lyrical about the Islamic world. Mm. Who could possibly rate this? That's quite nice.
It's nice.
But there's no way he's given it 0 stars. So it's got to be 5, doesn't it?
No. So you'll be very surprised here. I think Tamer El Shamari here has misunderstood the star rating. He's given it 1 star.
Right. That's not... So he's trying his best.
Yeah, it was very poetic, but then he just didn't click 5 stars. He clicked 1. I mean,
yeah,
maybe he thinks this is the only number 1, so I can kind of give a concession to that. Anyway.
Well, exactly. Yeah. Like, it is the most monotheistic of all there is no God but God.
That's it.
Yeah. So makes 1 star for the one God.
So,
yeah.
So that
was. Is that blasphemy?
We'll ask the listener.
Blasphemy, blast for you, blast for everyone listening.
Yeah.
Go for it.
Can we quote that? That's just out of context, that would be great. I've got 2 more reviews you might enjoy. So this is from Mohammed Tala, and he says, I wish they add more labels and information boards for people who don't speak Arabic.
All right, Big Mo, coming in here without... You're a Muslim. The Quran's in Arabic. What are you doing? I had 2 stars.
So he hasn't quite finished yet. This might sway it a bit more. He says, okay. Staff is very rude and don't respect or care, especially older senior citizens. They will not allow you to go inside and touch the Kaaba. Very disappointed.
Well, of course not. It's Big Mo's having a nightmare here. I don't think Big Mo's really got the whole vibe, has he?
No. Can you guess what star he gave it?
He must be giving it 1 star then.
He's a Mr. 1 star. Yeah, he's on a 1 star.
Unbelievable. Yeah.
But we have 1 more, and I think you might like this one. This is from Aisha. So good they named her twice. Nice. She says, no words can describe the beauty, but I had an issue with management. Poor...
Oh, Aisha. I was transported to an ephemeral plane, but the doors got stuck a little bit and the driver was a bit rude.
So this is it. Poor management lady workers locked my mum in the washroom.
Do you know what? Fair enough, Aisha. That would put a damper on it.
She was locked in there for almost 20 minutes and me and my brother went crazy to find her. If you visit, please be there with your elders. Anyone who wants to go, please give me a message so you can enjoy your experience. So she's offering her help.
That's nice. That's a good word from Aisha. That's kind of her.
Very kind.
Man. Can you just give me those first 2 sentences again? Because that has tickled my brain.
Good. So, no words could describe the beauty, but I had an issue with management.
Oh, that is wonderful.
That's fantastic.
Thank you, Aisha. So she can't be giving it 1 star then, because she's had a knockout time, but the admin's been poor. So I'm going to say that's a 3 star.
Yeah, you think
it feels 3 star to me.
I think she's been smitten by the initial experience of giving it 5.
Oh, okay. Well, that's okay. Good work, Aisha. Still going to give it 5-star. Not going to. You don't want to damage the local businesses.
No, exactly.
Which I'm sure need the Google reviews at Mecca. Man, I want to get in the brain of these people who go around reviewing like the Eiffel Tower,
right?
And do it. I love sincere Google reviews.
That's great.
Anybody cares,
but you get some,
brilliant.
And it's even better. The reason I found these reviews is because you can search Google reviews for keywords, so that made it even more fun.
Well, all right. What was the keyword for the last one? Was it elder people toilet?
No, it was the word crazy.
Nice.
Oh, dear.
Right, my number time.
Go on.
It's all fun and games with me this week.
I can't wait.
And so your number is 20.
Yep.
And your clue is the games.
20 and the games. Just for what it's worth, I've lost the game, if anyone knows that.
I had a streak of a good 15, 20 years going there. It must be nearly.
And the best thing about this is that people might listen to this podcast in years' time, and I've ruined someone.
Exactly. it's like a time capsule. That was a pigs in blanket that we had at the beginning of the...
Yeah.
You've taken that pig in blanket that's actually a cat turd wrapped in bacon and chucked it in a time capsule to be opened up by someone in the future.
No,
good work.
I'm very happy about that. But anyway, back to your back to your question about the games and the number 20.
The games and number 20. Yeah.
Is this how many games there have been? I'm thinking Olympic Games here. Is it something like that?
Keep going.
That's it. How many?
How is that it? That's like, oh, well, I've got a pizza base and I've got a jar full of tomato sauce and I've got some cheese. Dinner's ready, boys. I don't think it is.
No. Okay, let's cook this up then. So the games and 20. So I said that's how many games there have been since its inception, since it's begun.
Okay, right. No, I see. Not quite.
Okay.
Right, I see. Not quite. Have another go.
Okay, how many... it's a how many, isn't there? How many...
It is a how many.
...games there have... been...
You're saying the same words again, Rich.
I need to change the end of it to make it different now. I need the extra clue before I run out of... before I say the same thing again and get it wrong again.
Right, well, the extra clue was Olympics.
Oh,
so,
sugar.
I mean, we're through the doorway here. We're past the threshold.
God. Is it...
I can't really give you an extra clue without just telling you the answer.
Okay, so this is... Oh, okay, well, how...
I'll give you... It's the ancient Olympics. I'll tell you that much. It's the ancient Greek Olympics.
Okay. So it won't be like how many events there were in Olympic Games or something like that.
Nailed it.
Oh, really?
That's exactly what it is.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. How many events were there in the original Olympic Games?
Oh, that is excellent.
Yeah, that's it.
Oh, I actually know some things about this as well, so I'm happy to really contribute to this. I think I know some things.
Yeah, tell us about it. What do you know?
So so it was a Frenchman who came up the modern Olympic Games called I can't remember his name.
Coubertin.
And my favourite things about this is there are Olympic events that obviously don't exist anymore. Tug of War was in it once in 1916 London. There was also town planning, I think, was in it.
Yep.
Poetry, essay writing, and sort of these kind of like mental sort of cognitive tasks and events. That's good fun. I'm not too clued up on the ancient games because the reason I know this, I did A level in PE and we looked at the history of the Olympics as the modern movement.
Right.
So that's why I can vaguely remember some things. And then there was the, and you keep going, in terms of modern Olympics, you got the, is it the Jesse Owen incident in Hitler's Olympic Stadion in Berlin? That's the case. Is that right? Or was that?
Yeah, 1936, exactly. But the thing is, so there's a bit of a misconception there, at the risk of blowing a misconception corner, people thought that Hitler specifically didn't shake the hand of Jesse Owens because he was a black man, but that's not true.
Oh.
Hitler started,
Oh,
do you know it?
I think he didn't shake the hands of anyone.
Yeah, he started off only shaking the hands of the Germans, and people started saying, that's a bit, you can't do that kind of thing. And Hitler, for literally the only time in his life, said, yeah, fair enough. I'll stop doing okay. that weird thing that I was doing that was a bit racist.
Out of all things to stop doing when you've been told, that was the one. What an absolute helmet.
In hindsight, probably should have let him have that one because, and then rode him back on some of the later stuff.
Maybe, good idea. Yeah. Anyway.
But no, the irony about Jesse Owens is that he was awarded everything in Berlin that he was could have been awarded. He was given the wreath, he was given the flowers, he was given the golden medal. But then when he comes back to the United States, he has a parade in New York and he has a gala, a big celebration at, I can't remember which hotel it is, but I think it's the, is there a Ritz in New York? It's one of the big hotels in New York. And because he was black and because this was 1936, his name was above the door, Jesse Owens celebrating winning a gold medal. Mm. And he was the guest of honor and he had the top place at the table and it was all about him. But he wasn't allowed in the front entrance.
Wow.
He had to go in through the kitchen.
Oh my God. That's insane. So he's still a second class citizen, even though he'd won all these medals. That's insane.
It's insane. And even though they were celebrating him as you are the hero of the United States. But you've got to go in through the kitchens.
Yeah, that's
crazy.
Wow,
crazy.
Well, yeah. Can we regain some faith in some humanity via the ancient Olympics and their 20 events?
Sure. Let me tell you about the ancient Olympics. Well, let me tell you one thing that probably won't come as a surprise because it's so they start in 776 BC, so they're really old.
Okay.
This is like before written language old.
Oh, wow.
And they end somewhere around about 200 BC, so they go on for about 500 years.
Okay.
Which is pretty impressive.
That's very impressive.
women weren't allowed in them ever.
Okay. Just,
it's only for men. So and married women weren't even allowed to watch it.
So they knew their place in that time. No go, unfortunately for you.
Which is not allowed at the sport for... No. Well, the reason why is because, first of all, women were second-class citizens, as they have been throughout most of human history. But also because everything was done in the nude.
Yes.
The men were completely starkers, butt naked.
I did. Yeah, that's one thing I think I did know about that was the nudity. And they had little strings to hold their fella out of the way, I think, whilst they were doing events. Or is that a mis? Have I just gone on dodgy websites and read that incorrectly?
I think we're now reading from Reese's dream book again.
Okay, maybe.
Oh, yeah. I don't think that's the case.
Sorry, I've left it open on my desk.
but the interesting thing about them being in the nude is that the Greek for naked is gymnos. And so the word gymnasium is the place where people go and are naked.
Oh, wow.
It's the naked place.
So
I'm going to the gym means I'm going to the place where people are naked.
So that's the equivalent of going to a German sauna. It's exactly the same
exactly.
thing. So they should.
It is exactly the same thing.
Ah, okay. Yeah. That's very interesting. I'm glad I know that now.
Fill in all them gaps in knowledge. Oh, yeah. There you go. So the idea behind them being naked is that they couldn't hide anything on their body, like couldn't have any special tricks up their sleeve to win.
Right.
They couldn't cheat. That's the idea. But let me tell you about some of the events.
But just to interject there, unlike the modern Olympics, where it's all hidden inside of their body.
Well, exactly. I mean, you can be naked and still be very much on steroids.
Yeah, exactly right.
Like, it's not all that hard. Yeah. But so some of the events, the very first event, do you want to guess what the very first event at the very first Olympics was?
I imagine they went hard quickly. So there was some sort of like either explosive thing that was exciting, like a dash or a throw. I reckon I'm going to go with a run. I'm going to say like a 100-meter dash.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's the most basic competition is... That obviously who can run fastest is the most simple human competition, surely. And it's about 200 meters. And for the first 14 Olympic Games, which take place over about 50 years, that's all they do.
Right.
Just 200 meters. And whoever wins has won the Olympics.
Oh, wow.
And then they think in 724 BC, let's spice this up a little bit. Who can run 400 meters?
Oh.
Same event, just double it.
Okay.
And it takes them almost 100 years before they come up with another event. Do you want to guess what the third event is? And to give you a clue, think the most basic things that human beings do athletically.
So I was going to say throw something far. That's going to be my next one.
There's something more simple than throwing.
Is it jumping over something?
Jumping's a really good guess, but they don't come up with jumping just yet.
Okay.
No.
Is it?
Maybe even more. If I use the word primal, I
was,
give you a clue.
I was going to say fighting was the next one.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
Boxing.
Boxing.
Yeah. In the 23rd Olympiad. Yeah, they come up with boxing. So it takes about 100 years before they come up with boxing. And then I'm going to skip a few events to come up with my next favorite one, which is in the 41st Olympiad. So another 70 years down the line, someone says, I like all this boxing, but there's not enough children getting permanent brain damage. Let's do boys' boxing.
Nice. Nice.
So yeah, they're giving each other brain damage from 616 BC. But in 520 BC, they introduced the main event of the Olympiad, which is called the Hoplitodromos,
okay.
Which is basically getting dressed up in armor and then going for a run around. But because they're saucy Greeks, what they mean by armor is you got to wear a helmet, you got to wear a shield, you got to wear shin pads and nothing else.
Of course, that's what they're doing. That's what they do.
Yep.
Taking gym to its full extent.
They really are, yeah. And they don't really come up with anything interesting until about 400 BC, when finally they come up with competition for trumpeters.
For what, sorry?
The Olympiad for trumpeters.
Trumpeters?
Trumpeters, people who play the trumpet.
Oh, wow, okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it was a musical competition.
Musical competition, except the question is, how clear is their trumpet? No, not. This isn't Gavs in Knowledge After Dark. How well can you hear their trumpet?
Oh, I see. Okay. It's not like how blocked is their trumpet?
No. I think they would still have to be naked for this, though.
Okay, of course.
But this has led to a couple of fantastic Wikipedia entries for winners of the trumpet competition because we know their names and we know what they were good at.
Right.
And so just one example is the Wikipedia entry for a man called Herodorus of Megara,
yeah.
Who was noted for his large size and the loudness of his trumpet playing, which is... Isn't that a wonderful little mental story to play yourself there?
It's lovely.
He's really big, and that trumpet is really bloody loud.
That's very good. That's fantastic. I want to be remembered by something like that. That's
exactly. Yeah.
Oh.
He was known for the size of his beard and just how loud he sneezed.
Yeah, and that is, you need nothing more in life than to be remembered with that. That should be on your epitaph. Absolutely. Are you ready to do the outro, Will?
Let's do it.
Is that a professional segue into the outro?
No.
Okay, so
welcome to the outro.
Oh my God. Okay, here we go. You've caught me off. I've managed to catch myself off guard with that because
I had no part in this. You're chasing your own tail.
I am at the moment. Yeah, but we've made it to the end of the episode. We've had a lot of laughs.
But we've learned something. More importantly, we've learned something along the way.
We have learned a lot on the way. If anything, that's what this podcast is meant to be about, hopefully. So if you would like to follow our socials, you can do on, we're on Twitter at Gaps Podcast, and we're also on YouTube. Just search us there and you'll find us.
It's not called Twitter anymore.
Oh God, X, whatever. Elon Musk, X. Ugh.
We're on X.
X.
I did the arms.
You did do the arms. I saw it.
I know this isn't a video, but I did the arms. No, we are on Twitter. We're not on X because I... come on.
Yeah. You didn't do the arms then. As a child.
I didn't do the arms. but we are also on Facebook, which isn't yet called Meta, I don't think.
No.
Who knows what's... But we are on Facebook, so just search for Gaps in Knowledge and you'll find our page there. And you can email us, gapsinknowledge@outlook.com. And you can, of course, leave a message on Spotify using the newfangled Spotify message leaving service. So scroll down and it should all be made clear to you.
And hopefully our listeners are educated enough to at least be able to do that. But Is that unnecessary dig for no reason?
just coming in hot. Yeah, if you can work your own work your way around a phone, you morons.
Anyway, on that, let's get out of here before it gets too heated. Have a good week, everyone.
Bye bye. Love you. Bye.